This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
This is The Informer, a Joy 94.9 podcast. This podcast was made possible with support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. To support the production of content like this, donate at cbf.com.au.
If you have been affected by this story, we encourage you to call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Or if you want a more LGBT-focused organisation, you can contact Switchboard on switchboard.org.au or on 1800 184 527.
So, how is your mental health today? We all have a state of mental health, and many experts now suggest we think of this as a continuum. At one end of the continuum, many of us will experience positive mental health, and we're currently travelling pretty well, thank you. Some of us will be experiencing mild and moderate symptoms of mental health distress, and at the other end, there'll be a group who experience severe symptoms who deserve expert support and care. Those of us who've had or who have had mental health struggles also know that recovery is possible, and living with mental health struggles is just one part of life. There is currently a Royal Commission into Mental Health in Victoria. It's just the latest in dozens of inquiries over the last two decades, which have examined improving and reforming mental health systems and the services for Australians. Now, this Victorian Commission will likely run for about 2 years, and the promise is that it will overhaul how governments and services tackle mental health issues across all communities. At public hearings last week at the Melbourne Town Hall, the Royal Commission on Mental Health heard evidence from experts working within and for the LGBTIQ community. Why are rates of mental health distress about twice as high in LGBTIQ populations than in the general Australian population? What are the impacts of discrimination, violence and isolation and family relationships on developing mental health problems? Do LGBTIQ people feel that support and mental health services are welcoming and safe? And what can be done to encourage help seeking earlier? And what about our attitudes and behaviours towards people with mental health issues, and indeed ourselves? How can we be a bit more understanding, kinder and less stigmatising? Tonight on The Informer, we talk to four people from our LGBTIQ community who all have a lived experience of mental health. We hear some of the evidence that the Victorian Gender and Sexuality Commissioner presented publicly to the Royal Commission last week.
We're not asking for special treatment. We're asking for fair and reasonable treatment to live in dignity, to access services that unfortunately we need at a higher level.
We talked to mental health stigma warrior Paul about his experience as a man living with bipolar and depression.
I try and make it as normal as it is. I talk about, where have you been today, psych? And I laugh and say, you know, like, I must have been really good because they let me out. So try and generalise it, try and make it softer.
We hear from mental health peer worker Eric about the importance of social connection and actively listening to people in the recovery journey.
We sometimes forget when we're really unwell that connecting will do something good for us. So having other people around us that can point us to how we might put our lives back together, I think that's really crucial.
And we hear from Maria, a Beyond Blue ambassador and policy expert, about what needs to change in the mental health system.
We have to find some bipartisan agreement on this. It's been declared by the Premier as a national emergency. We've heard Scott Morrison now appoint a suicide advisor and talking about ramping up efforts in mental health.
First up, we hear from Ro Allen, Victorian Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality. Last week, Ro was a public witness to the Royal Commission on Mental Health. She spoke about multiple issues, including discrimination, families, communities, minority stress, that plebiscite, self-welcoming mental health services. Here are a few choice moments from Ro's evidence.
It is not our gender identity, our sexuality, or our intersex variation that is the cause of our mental health. It is actually the discrimination that we experience, the isolation, the family rejection, that is the cause of that. So that's my major focus, I'd say. Everything I do is for the better mental health of the LGBTI community. I think that the constant living with the fear of being discriminated against, I mean, my own personal experience of physical harm and violence, it has an accumulative effect. And we don't always get included in services and mental health services. I think it's important to remember that in mental health services, it's only in the 70s did homosexuality come off the DSM as a mental disorder, you know, and so there's that stigma that's attached to that. It was only last year that being trans or gender diverse came off the DSM as a mental disorder.
And what are the implications of that?
Well, it's the belief, it's the self-shame that people carry. You know, we don't wake up in the cot hating ourselves. It comes from somewhere. And it's that stigma about how we are labelled and identified, whether it's through the media, whether it's through the recent postal survey, which was a tsunami of attacks on our mental health, and an actual campaign against our mental health. It comes from those places, and we carry that. And obviously LGBTIQ people at different levels carry a different level of that depending on their life experience. But it's also the perception of how you may be experienced, and not just the reality of that. Certainly for trans and gender diverse folk, just if you don't fit in the what community and our society understands as gender norms, just going on public transport, you know, you may need to be constantly vigilant. I live with that myself. I'm constantly vigilant about where I am and what I'm doing, and I'm always scouring for safety in relation to just travelling through the world. It's not uncommon. It's not uncommon to just have abuse yelled at you as an LGBTI person from a passing car. In my case, many others, you never know whether that's going to escalate into anything potentially violent. And then there's other things that you live with around access and inclusion in services. And the Royal Commission was absolutely fabulous today. You arrived, you was incredibly welcomed. There was very friendly security, very friendly welcoming party. There's crayons and colouring books for kids. There's every tea and coffee room, everything you can imagine. But when I asked for the bathroom, I was directed to male and female bathroom. Now, for me, who is gender non-conforming or gender diverse, instantly it raises anxiety. To be honest, I came early because of that. I often turn up early to places. I also knew that everybody in the gallery, or some people in the gallery, may be LGBTIQ, and it may be another issue for them. So I was able to make sure that everybody here at the Royal Commission, when they were asked, they sent a little WhatsApp message around to all the staff that they wouldn't just direct people and just assume that they were male or female, that they would make it accessible. And I've got the lights on the third level, and there's, you know, it's all of those things that you live with every day. The fact that I know every, gender-neutral safe toilet in metropolitan Melbourne and most of rural Victoria is alarming. But that's not an individual, that's quite a common experience. In fact, there's apps for safe toilets, and it's, again, we talk about the stigma. I hope that's not the media grab that comes today. Commissioner comes early to Royal Commission to scope toilets. But,
I think you might have just made it into the media grab.
I've just done that.
Can you say a bit more about negative stereotyping as a risk factor for development of poor mental health outcomes?
Absolutely. If I remember as a youth worker speaking to young people, and the only kind of media or connection to community they would often see, particularly in rural and remote communities, was on television. And they'd get this picture of Mardi Gras, and they'd see, half-naked drag queen, and they think, well, that's not me. But they don't see the 100,000 people that are marching for their rights and their freedoms. And that's how we are a resilient community. We experience so much discrimination. We come together to celebrate ourselves and identity because the other parts of community haven't always celebrated us. And yet what we get fed back to us are, particular images and frantic things about toilets and trans people in toilets and all this other sort of stuff. So the messaging we get back all the time is that you are perverts, that you're deviants, that are you pedophiles, all of these misconceptions. And so, as I said, you don't wake up in the cot hating yourself. All this stuff is accumulative and builds to our minority stress and how we develop understandings. It also stops us from accessing mental health services because the sense of not being worthy. The number of elders in my community that have said, no, Commissioner, just make it better for young people. We've had our time, And it also, it's a lovely gesture, but it also, I know it comes from a place of not feeling worth and valuable. And it's so important that we value our elders and community because they have experienced enormous levels of discrimination. I was married 3 months ago, happiest day of my life. I would give it up in a heartbeat if it meant I could undo the 3 months of torture and trauma, really, it was on our community. People who have been out for a long time, people who are really employed, you know, well-to-do, feel quite secure in themselves and their identity, whose family supports them, talk to me about all sorts of triggers that that period gave. And they were the people that were doing very well. So then it doesn't take much to think about the people in our community who are already vulnerable. Many in our community completely switched off their social media during, and I recommended that, but they switched off their support. So as well as switching off seeing all the negative things, during that period they also switched off from being able to get connections and support. Every day you could open a newspaper or turn on the radio or anything and hear that you're going to hell. You know, it was a regular event, letter to the editor, the slippery slope argument, all the things that were coming to us. I remember, for me personally, that you know, my partner, now wife, and I thought we would protect our child for the next 3 months. That was ridiculously naive, because it was everywhere. You know, when you're, as I was, standing in front of a group of people delivering, you know, LGBTI training and talking about how important it was, behind me, out the window, was a plane riding a ginormous no in the air. Now that everybody could see that, there was an awkward uncomfortableness, and eventually I turned around. You know, but not only did that no affect me, you know, in a visceral way, I knew that the kids in my kids' school were watching that. All the rainbow kids in schools all over Melbourne were seeing that. Every LGBTI person that was vulnerable was seeing that no in the air. You know, you couldn't avoid that, and you know, it can't but, and it attacked my mental health, and I know it affected so many people. For me, you know, I have a very, very supportive work environment. My boss is the Minister for Mental Health. You know, it was very clear that I was going to get support and counselling every 2 weeks during the postal survey. Would not have looked good for the Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality to fall over, but not everybody can afford to do that.
That was Ro Allen, who's Victorian Commissioner for Gender and Sexuality. All of the mental health experts agree that services and policy changes need to meaningfully engage with people who have a lived experience of mental health issues. The current buzz term is known as co-design. However, the stigma of disclosing and talking about mental health is very real, and many people are concerned that talking publicly about that experience of mental health may have negative consequences for them. For The Informer, I spoke to three further people from our community who are absolutely determined to break down the misunderstandings about living with mental health conditions and to addressing how mental health stigma is a major barrier to getting support and recovery. Paul Camilleri is a gay man who's lived with bipolar for several years now. He's also a public speaker, and he was happy to share some of his experience and insights.
You can call me Paul, and I'm happy in my box.
What does that mean?
Well, some people aren't comfortable with their diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I am, because I, for a long time, didn't know what was happening. And then when they gave me diagnosis, I went, okay, I can work with that, because I can work out how the best way to be treated and work towards that. And that's what I do.
Tell us a little bit about your journey, Paul. I mean, what was your experience of mental health services like at the beginning?
In the beginning, it was nothing really. There was none. It was just like splash. I had depression for a very long time before I went manic, and it was just like, oh, have another antidepressant, and they were kept on just upping and upping and upping and upping, to the side effects were horrendous, where I was getting really bad pains, because it was making my muscles constrict and my jaw was rigid and I was biting and had to get mouth guards and all that sort of stuff. But they didn't get that I had bipolar till I actually was in a house fire situation. And while I was in hospital, they'd realised, oh, bipolar.
You're a gay man?
Yes.
How do you describe yourself?
Yes, yeah. Of course.
I'm
very festive.
What difference has it made being a gay man and the sort of mental health services that you've been able to access? Have you found those services to be friendly, appropriate?
Well, sadly, I didn't have any services till I actually contracted HIV, and then it opened a whole world. And yes, I could be bitter about my HIV, but in some ways with my mental health, you know, all of a sudden I had a sea of psychiatrists, psychologists, and mental health support. And like at the Alfred, Mark Jeans, who's one of the best psychiatrists in Australia, and I just had access to him. Whereas before, I just got my script done by my doctor, 15 minutes, and I had one free every 3 months psychiatrist appointment at the Melbourne clinic with a little man in a safari suit that I couldn't relate to.
So it sounds like the services that you had back in the day were really not very LGBTI friendly at all.
They weren't, no.
Can you talk a little bit about, do you think that the LGBTI community is comfortable with those of us that have an experience of all different shapes and forms of mental health?
I think the reality is mental health and HIV, the community, our community, the LGB, is more judgmental, I've found.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And sadly, it's not getting better.
So when you say it's judgmental, that means... How does that impact you?
With friendships, like there was when I first moved to Melbourne, I didn't know very many people. I met somebody, and it was a good fit because he liked nice clothes, and it was like art galleries, nice lunch, wine bar, that sort of stuff. And then it started to get very uncomfortable, and it was almost like I was like pushed in to fit in. And then one day, talking about movies, and every time I talked about a movie, he'd been and already seen it with these other guys. And I said, you know, why can't I just come? He said, they don't want to know you because you have bipolar and they're quite frightened about that. And I went, what? Really?
What do you think was behind that? Do you think it was fear, ignorance?
All of it, I think, in their little perfect world. And then I was on a tram not long after, and he was on there and said, oh, we acknowledged each other and had a chat. And he said, what I had been doing. And I said that I was volunteering and I was doing a course and that sort of stuff, you know. And he said, oh, so you're still trying to make out that you're normal. And I went, what? I said, I still have goals. You know, I still do stuff. And so that was really good because when I think about it, I really dodged a bullet, didn't I? I didn't really need him and I didn't really need his friends. But at the time, it was incredibly hurtful because I wasn't equipped then to go, okay, that guy's not very nice. Their issue, not mine. At that stage, I was quite wounded because it seemed like I wasn't good enough.
Mm. What about how we disclose our mental health issues? I mean, I have a history of depression and anxiety. You have a history of bipolar and depression. And when do we bring that into a conversation? And how important is it in breaking down stigma that actually we acknowledge this is a part of us? This is
I try and make it as normal as it is. I talk about, where have you been today, psych? And I laugh and say, you know, like, I must have been really good because they let me out. stuff like that. I try and generalise it. Try and make it softer.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's still a lot of ignorance, a lot of fear of people with a mental illness or with a diagnosis, you know, that such as you have. They just don't know what it means.
No, and our portrayal is never good on the television. We're usually this psychopath that's stalking and, you know, there's never a good rap with anybody with bipolar.
We've been speaking to a few people about resilience and community. Do you think there's things that we should be doing in the mental health system, in the wider health system, which is really supporting people, not just medicalizing them?
Yeah, exactly. There isn't any drop-in centers anymore. There isn't anything much anymore where you wanted to just hang out and have a coffee and have a chat to a psychologist or something. They're all gone. NDIS has stopped that. Mm. It's closed.
So what has, from your experience, been the impact of the NDIS on people living with a mental health issue?
Well, it's lost because I had a worker from FAMS, which is a unit from the Salvation Army, and I had an amazing gay woman who looked after me immensely, and we had a really good relationship, and that relationship was like, okay, Paul, this isn't bipolar, you're being a dickhead. Snap out of it. And sometimes I'd be whiny and she'd like hang up and then ring me back a half hour. Are you ready to behave? That's what I needed. It was real. There was no rubbish. There was no here, paint yourself better, you know, with a nice mandala. It was a real relationship. Yeah, that's what we did.
Did you say that she was from the Salvation Army?
Yeah.
So has come up.
And what happened was when the Salvation Army decided it didn't want to join FAMS, so she lost her job and I lost the worker. They shut down the program.
Do you want to say something maybe about your experience of faith-based organizations that and how LGBTI-friendly they are? It's come up at the Royal Commission from a couple of people that some faith-based organizations have signed up to, or a number of them have signed up to, non-discriminatory practice and working with LGBTI people. But also, you know, this goes back to when being gay was on the DSM, when it was in the manual, and they may be subject to something like conversion therapy through a religious based organization.
Evangelism,
yeah. So would you have a hesitation about working with a faith-based organization?
I'll give anything a go once, and if I don't like it and I don't feel that I'm respected, I would move on.
That was mental health stigma warrior Paul, and this is The Informer on Joy. We're talking about the lived experience of mental health. Coming up, we talk to mental health peer worker Eric, and we will also hear about the role of faith-based organisations in delivering mental health services in Victoria. What would your message, Paul, be as someone who has all of this deep experience, be to other LGBTI people who have mental health issues or are concerned about their mental health? What would your message to them be about navigating through these services?
If you have a psychologist, you don't like them, don't stop. Keep on going till you find one that you do have a relationship. Because it's like life. You'll get people you don't like.
That is Ian Muchamore's report, speaking with Paul there. And look, we're obviously talking about a number of quite challenging mental health conditions. Thank you so much to Paul for sharing his story with us. But if anything that we're talking about here is raising issues for you, you can call Lifeline on 131114 or Switchboard on 1800 184 527, or you can go online, switchboard.org.au. I've got to say, some of what Paul was talking about there in terms of experiences speaking to psychologists and psychiatrists is something I can kind of relate to. Like, I have attention deficit disorder, and I remember going to see, like, I was struggling with a bit of anxiety and when I was at university, and sat down to chat to this shrink, and he says, so tell me what's going on. And he's like, you know, an old guy in his 60s. And I said, oh, you know, and I mentioned that I was gay casually. He said, oh, well, that's it then, isn't it? I was like, what? No, like literally, we had to talk through, and that was not the problem. You know, the problem was this whole bunch of related things. And I think some of what Paul was saying there too rings true to me. When you have people who talk you down or who it might be a partner, it might be people around you, there aren't those same safety nets. Because I think when you're part of our community, we're so used to there being this constant subset of people, and they are a smaller group now than they were when, you know, we were all growing up, but who are talking us down and saying, you know, you're wrong, you're bad. And so when events in your life or your mental health kind of, you know, fails a little bit, it kind of confirms what those people have been saying all along.
And you just mentioned at the top as well, organisations such as Switchboard, which you mentioned, which are so accessible and so fantastic just to reach out. I think they're opened until like midnight. I think they've got some great hours of to be able just to grab the phone and talk to somebody that actually understands you as well from our community.
Yeah, absolutely. It's very, very important. You are listening to The Informer.
Eric Glare has a lived experience of mental health, and I spoke to him about his journey of recovery and how he is now a peer worker with a large mental health service, where he's able to bring forward that experience into listening and supporting others. Especially when LGBTIQ people are struggling with mental health, Eric talks about the importance of peer support, having the right connections, community resilience, and why just listening and having a conversation can be so important in recovery.
We are social creatures. We sometimes forget when we're really unwell that connecting will do something good for us or something helpful. So having other people around us that can point us to how we might put our lives back together and how we might do that better than we did before, I think that's really crucial.
Does that look a bit different for us if we're a gay man or a lesbian or we're a trans person? Actually, that connectedness, because our families, our networks are different.
Essentially, it's not different, really, but the circumstances we find ourselves in can be a little bit different. And one thing I find is that issues of loneliness can be come to the forefront. Like, people might have friends and acquaintances, but when the going gets tough, they can find there's not anyone who they can actually talk to. So some people might find their family fills that role. But for other people, because they're gay or lesbian or trans, they don't quite fit with their family. Their family have trouble dealing with their sexuality or their gender diversity. So then to add on another layer will help me with my mental health as well. It can be just a little bit too much. But some people can end up with not having someone special in their life that they can talk to. And so this can be really serious if someone is fighting suicidal ideation, where being able to talk about something is very helpful in determining that this isn't a good feeling, that I shouldn't feel like this and I should get help. So being able to just say that you are unwell is really really important then. And so if you don't have that safe person, that conversation doesn't happen, and it's left up to psychiatrists and professional people, and which is not quite the same. It is, and it's all rigid with times, fortnight apart, a month apart, or whatever. And life doesn't work to those criteria. So, yes, LGBTI people can be missing that crucial link at the crucial time of their life.
In community, we often hear, can be part of building resilience. So whether that's having a radio station like Joy, or whether it's having a community organisation like Thorn Harbour Health or Living Positive Victoria, or one of those sporting clubs, for example, where people come together on a regular basis, that really can build that social connection, can't it?
Yes. I do come across people who have those connections and that work for them and are part of their resilience. But I see other people, it's not really a cup of tea. So what is? You know, what is it that we could do to help? How can we fill in those gaps? We can't expect everyone to have a friend that they put on quite hard, difficult topics that have their own danger in them as well.
And often we don't know how to have those conversations. I don't think we're supported as carers, as partners, as friends, to have some of those conversations. We're not quite sure whether we're going to do good or whether we're going to do something that might be harmful.
I think we could challenge that, really, because one of the big things is we just want to be heard. Mm-hmm. The act of voicing, the act of telling the story is so important to getting it out and getting it worked out. So if you're just a listener, you've done the great strides of getting there already. You don't have to be wise and profound. You just have to listen. And you just have to reflect back that you understood. So saying to somebody, oh yes, that sounds like too much pain and agony, that's helpful. Just acknowledging someone's pain. Because that then might help them go, well, shit, I need help.
Yeah.
I deserve help.
Yeah.
I'm ready for help.
So it's
just the conversation. And I think we're all quite capable of that, or most of us are, if we could get over that little hurdle.
Is there something that you would really like to see change in the system? I mean, you've got deep experience of the mental health system, personal and professional. And this Mental Health Commission says that it's about changing the system. What would you like to see change, especially for LGBTI people?
Well, I really think the change is to be patient-centred, person-centred, to be tailor-making the service. I think we're already starting to do that, but it's so often strapped by resources. And what comes out the end often is just a rubber stamping or a commonality or a standard one-size-fits-all or whatever. What we need to get much better at is the layering of services, to realise that people are complex individuals, and just treating themselves with a psychiatrist might be saving their life, but it doesn't address all the other issues. And we all deserve a team. We don't deserve just to have one person. You know, even a team looks at your car when you get it serviced, so why shouldn't we have a team?
So when you sit down as a peer worker, what happens?
Well, the first thing is I check in with how they're coping. So I'm someone who comes along and asks, is everything working out okay? And can we fine-tune things? And the look on people's face when I start with that is great. And then I get involved with the issues that they have. And then many of those issues perhaps are clinical issues that are not really my sphere.
Mm-hmm.
So I quickly steer the conversation to the things that I'm good at talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of those things is about finding our way, and how we discover ourselves, how we learn about how we function under distress, how we have to put ourselves back together, and what that recipe is for our recovery. And so the message is that we learn to be much better people because of what's happened to us. We come out of the end of our trauma being far more empathetic people, far more kinder to other people because of what's happened to us. And that is a great benefit to us.
That was Eric Glare talking to The Informer about the importance of conversations, peer support, and learning from our own experiences of mental health struggles. Coming up, we talk to a woman who first revealed her mental health struggles in an opinion piece in The Age some 12 years ago. Maria Katsonis is another person from our LGBTIQ community that hasn't been shy to champion mental health issues. Maria is a Beyond Blue ambassador. I first asked her how it was that she recognised that there was an issue for her and how she found help and treatment.
I was extraordinarily fortunate, I have to say. For me, my experience of mental illness was a very acute episode of depression. And at first, I didn't understand what was actually happening to me because the symptoms were so acute. They affected me physically as well as mentally and also cognitively. And I didn't equate with what I had as depression. And then when finally I realised I had depression, I refused to accept that. I suffered, in fact, a form of self-stigma and came to the conclusion that people like me, describe myself as type A, achievement-oriented, goal-focused, at that point, very work-driven, don't experience depression because I kind of equated it with a character flaw. So I didn't seek help straight away because I thought I could deal with the issues on my own until it got to the point where it became very life-threatening for me in relation to the severity of the symptoms I was experiencing, contemplating suicide as a way to end the pain and the misery. And when I just stumbled across a GP, literally the first GP I rang, got an appointment, realising I needed help. And I was extremely fortunate to have encountered a GP who was compassionate, showed a great deal of empathy with me as a person not only experiencing depression, but no judgment about my sexual orientation or any other aspect. So I didn't experience any issues, if you like, in accessing services as a result of my sexuality or the illness that I was experiencing at the time. But I do think it was luck.
That was Maria Katsonis, and on The Informer, we're talking about LGBTIQ mental health experiences and how the mental health system in Victoria could be improved for us all. Maria is also a public policy expert, having previously held senior policy roles in the Victorian government, and she's now a public policy fellow with the University of Melbourne. Maria told me that there's also another national inquiry into mental health currently underway, conducted by the Productivity Commission. Maria told me that there's another national inquiry into mental health currently underway, and it's being conducted by the Productivity Commission. She says there's some opportunity for bipartisan agreed mental health reforms, with both state and the Australian government involved. The last word, though, goes to the Gender and Sexuality Commissioner, Ro Allen, talking here to the Royal Commission last week about what needs to change in mental health services so they're safe, welcoming and non-discriminatory.
So we have two concurrent inquiries. We have the Productivity Commission and we have the Royal Commission. And in fact, we have to find some bipartisan agreement on this. It's been declared by the Premier as a national emergency. We've heard Scott Morrison now appoint a suicide advisor and talking about ramping up efforts in mental health. Because, you know, if you read some of the evidence that's gone to the Royal Commission by way of submissions, for example, people are talking about the limitations, if you like, of a mental health plan. Well, the reality is a mental health plan falls under the Commonwealth. It isn't necessarily a state issue. And I think perhaps, again, going to the symbolism of both the Commission inquiry and also, as in the Productivity Commission inquiry, and the Royal Commission may well be that push that we need to overcome the inertia in relation to mental health.
When we think about On Joy, about the current government, the thing we most often think of in the politics space is the plebiscite around marriage equality.
Mm-hmm.
We have very strong evidence, as well as our personal experience, of the mental health damage that plebiscite did. So then, on the other hand, when we talk about we need a bipartisan approach and we need to trust the government when they say that they want to focus on suicide and they have a real interest in the mental health of minority communities such as ours, maybe we find that a bit difficult to take on board, to trust them?
Yeah, I don't disagree with you on that, Ian. I think we see in the current coalition government a strong divergence, if you like, within the party and within the government and within government members about how they view the LGBTI community and their attitudes towards the LGBTI community. We saw that in the run-up to the plebiscite, and we've seen that subsequently in other kind of commentary from various quarters. I think if we are going to make any great gains in this, it will be up to Scott Morrison as Prime Minister now to kind of unite the party within that regard. But it's difficult when we're talking about a government that, for which, you know, being socially progressive is not necessarily universally embraced. I don't have rainbows in front of my eyes, Ian. I'm not saying it's necessarily going to be an easy task. But the advantage of something like a productivity commission in the federal sphere is that it is at arm's length from government. It is the government's chief economic advisor. And remember that particularly for the productivity commission, they're looking at this from, you know, what is the cost to the economy in relation to mental health, whether it be presenteeism, you know, going to work when you are ill, whether it's to do with absenteeism as well. So I think something like the cost of the economy is something around about 4% of GDP. So they're not small numbers. So hopefully the weight of the evidence will be something that can counter, if you like, attitudes in this space.
You're listening to The Informer here on Joy 94.9. Many thanks goes out to Ian Muchamore for all his efforts in putting together all those stories. And fantastic stories as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Some real resilient voices out there that Ian got in contact with.
Yeah, and it does take a huge amount of courage, I think, to acknowledge that you face those kinds of challenges, like whether it was what Roe was reflecting on or Paul, or a lot of those reflections are deeply personal. And I think we need to get better as a society at kind of talking about this stuff and having dialogues around it.
Yeah, I'm actually currently seeking my own sort of form of mental health intervention, which is I'm sort of seeing a psychologist. Mm. And I'm not going to go into too much detail about that experience, but I do sort of want to say that that something that I learned through seeking out help is that you don't necessarily need to be, you know, facing a diagnosis of a mental health illness to go and seek out intervention just for the sake of your own day-to-day day-to-day health. Mm. You know, if you're facing anxiety, which I was, or you're facing, you know, depression, or there's just some, you know, general sadness or unhappiness that you're dealing with in your day-to-day that you can't seem to overcome, or that you can't seem to be able to put out of your mind, then, you know, seek out help. You know, the worst that can happen is that you waste your time. Mm. But the best that can happen is that you actually find something that'll help you get through the day.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, especially as men, we have sort of a habit of wanting to be able to power through things on our own. But, you know, treat it like just going to the GP. You know, if you feel sick, you go to the GP. If you feel depressed or anxious all the time, go and seek out mental health help.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think there is this false economy of shame around struggling with mental health issues. You know, like it kind of is almost treated as this character flaw. Like I remember about 5 or 6 years ago, one of my best friends, Stella Young, who was a disability advocate, died very, very suddenly. And I didn't really get over that properly for about 4 years. Like I probably had, like when I was kind of unpacking it ultimately with a psychologist in the same way that you're kind of talking through stuff now, Nick, you know, like he reflected, it kind of sounds like you kind of have post-traumatic stress disorder, like a form of that, because someone who was really important to you got taken away really, really suddenly. And it is okay to have feelings about that. And not why would we, anyone, naturally have the ability by ourselves to deal with those feelings? You know, humans evolved in like family groups of 20 to 50 people where you'd constantly be wandering around talking, whereas now we're, I think, you know, in a way very isolated together, you know, like we're connected through devices and through the internet and other things, but when it comes to actually just talking about how we're feeling and about some of the challenges that we all face, whether it's because of grief or mental health issues.
Yeah, and that's what the Royal Commission's all about. It is hearing all those stories from our community, and I can't harp on it about it more, but the organisations that are available to us here as a community are just so important. Apart from like Joy 94.9, there's some great content that's on here, and we're 24/7. It's fantastic. There's some great voices that come on our station, but there's also Switchboard, which you can access at 1-800-184-527 or switchboard.org.au. Mm-hmm. There's also Lifeline on 131114, and there's also Beyond Blue. There's Headspace. There's many great organisations out there.
Absolutely, there are. So that's just about all from The Informer tonight. Thank you very much to Ro Allen, Paul Camilleri, Eric Glare, Maria Katsonis, and all of the folk at the Royal Commission into Victoria's Mental Health System in the media and comms team for being so helpful. And thank you very much to Arian Potts for his excellent piece on the tragic death of Yelena in Russia. I've been Toby Halligan, presenting here with David Beckett and Nicholas Kamenia-Sandry. Thank you very much for listening.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.